We continue looking at ordinary people, extraordinary things. We've seen some extraordinary things in the last session about how, in spite of the work through Dwight L. Moody, that the influence of religion began to decline once again. And in fact, some people refer to the period of that we were looking at as a period of spiritual lethargy in the church. It's a powerful word. You know, some words have certain description to them that has power to it. Lethargy is one of those, that the church just couldn't seem to do anything. You know, sometimes I feel lethargic when it comes to mowing my lawn. I just don't want to do it, so I find all kinds of excuses not to do it. Well, a powerful description of the church was lethargy. So in this session, we're going to ask, how would God respond to that? Once again, the influence of the church is on the decline. The growth of the church is stopped, or membership in the church is on the decline. What would happen? What would God do as a response? Well, there were two of them, two things that happened that showed that God was still concerned about his church and still concerned about people coming to salvation and still concerned about people knowing him more deeply. One was ongoing revivals, and the other is the Pentecostal movement. And those two things are going to be the subject for this lecture today. So first of all, ongoing revivals. Now, I want you to get this distinction clear. You know, when we talked about revival early on, we were talking about what Jonathan Edwards talked about, and that is a supernatural coming to life again of somebody or some area as the Holy Spirit would fall in power and there would be this renewal that would happen, new life. Now, that had changed by this time. Now we've got a long history with revivalists and revivalism to holding a revival. In other words, a revival was something that you held, or you had a revival meeting. So a rather significant difference, coming to life versus holding meetings. Now, we've already seen how there has been a development that's been going on for a long time in making a pattern for revival. No, Jonathan Edwards wouldn't think about patterning one. He would just pray for a revival to happen. But Charles Finney brought his new measures, saying revival is not just something you've got to pray for. There are steps you can take that the Holy Spirit is predictable in how he brings about revival. And so if you just do this, you'll have a revival. And then Dwight Moody brought that even further by having advanced teams going into the town and fine-tuning that inquiry bench or that sense of coming to faith. Now it's become a pattern. And in fact, during this time, we find that revivalism now is being criticized, and not just criticized by people outside the church, but people inside the church in a variety of ways. The criticism came from three different areas. Some came from the social gospel. Okay, so there were those that we saw last time who emphasized that the church should be about changing society, and that's the point of the church, not changing souls, but changing physical characteristics, helping the hungry, clothing the naked, etc. That side of the gospel, an important side, is the side, and the side of salvation is not a side anymore. Well, they criticized it because they said it's so emotional and it really doesn't do anything. It doesn't do anything to help the hungry except give them that whole idea of pie in the sky by and by, that one day you're going to heaven. So that's one side there was criticism. The other side was from the conservatives. These are people who believe the basics. They were more toward the fundamentalism side of the spectrum of the church at that time that we looked at last time. And so these people said that revivalism is basically done. The picture there is of Reverend Dwight F. Pentecost. He was a fairly well-known revivalist, and in 1900, he quit. He resigned his position as a revivalist with a company, a group that had gone around from city to city, place to place, and done revivals, and said he was doing that because he didn't feel like the future of the church was in revivals. Rather, it was going to be through the work of the local church, and so he resigned as a revivalist and became a pastor in a local church. And the reasons that he said were, one, revivalism is done as a way, but also that it's not effective. As he looked at his work as a revivalist, he said, it's not doing what we want it to do in changing the world. This is one historian's reflection on that. The statistics appear to show that in eastern Massachusetts, for example, the addition to the evangelical churches for five-year periods after the Great Tabernacle meetings in Boston were not so large as for five-year periods before. In other words, they came in with a great big revival and said the church grew slower after the revival than it had grown before. And then says, and most pastors have observed that the quality of the material brought into the churches under these influences is not so high as that gained by the devoted work of the local church by its own methods among its own clientage. So they're saying it's not effective. We've got to find a different strategy, and it should be the local church. Now, the other side, third side for a criticism of revivalists and revivalism, were the moderates and liberals. These are the people who wanted to try to find some kind of, you know, cross between gospel and changing the society. And this is one statement about what they wanted. What they wanted was a revivalism which would be both intellectually respectable and emotionally fervent, which would show some awareness of the need for social reform and yet not substitute socialism for regenerating individuals. They felt that a more practical application of the Christian message was needed, but did not want the churches to take any stand on the controversial issues of capital and labor. In short, they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. And so the revivalism is ongoing, but there's criticism. And in fact, you know, statistics show that it was really ongoing. For instance, in 1911, there were 650 approximately full-time evangelists in this country. 650 people traveling around in 1911 and 1,200 part-timers. One publication estimated that between the years 1912 and 1918, 35,000 revivals. Now again, this is a period of any day of 2 days of meetings to 2 weeks of meetings where a revivalist challenges people to faith. 35,000 of those over that period of 1912 to 1918. And another source estimates that from 1914 to 1917, the church, the big church in the United States, spent $20 million per year on professional tabernacle evangelism. Now the references, we've hit it a couple of times already for tabernacle evangelism. And that's because there became a practice of moving not into a tent. You know, later on, tent became very important. But at this point, if a revival was going to come to town, they would build a plywood tabernacle. And so when you hear references to tabernacle evangelism, you've got to be picturing people out in a field somewhere outside the edge of town, and they're building a huge building in order to house the meetings for this coming week. $20 million in 1914 to 1970 dollars. Imagine that, would you? That's how much the church was still engaging in the process of revival. And God was bringing people to faith through this. So one of the responses of God to that decline that we looked at last time was to kind of up the ante. You know, the church continued to bring people to faith. And some of the clientage of that was changing. In other words, it wasn't the educated people. They tended to be the moderates and liberals, but it tended to be the poorer people. It tended to be more in the small towns than in the large cities. But still, there were revivals going on. Now, the best known of the revivalists during that time is a man named Billy Sunday. And again, if you were going to choose somebody that you'd say, that's the man that God's going to use, that's the person, you wouldn't have said that about Billy Sunday. He was born November 19, 1862. He was, by 12/23/1862, fatherless. His father was in the Civil War and was killed. And so he becomes somebody who's with a mother who now has three children to take care of and therefore in poverty. Now his grandfather, Squire Corey, took care of the father, the mother and the children a great deal during those years. And then the mother remarried, and that's another story. But Billy Sunday, in those first few years, was not a healthy man. In fact, a boy, rather. In fact, this statement about his life. During the first 3 years of his life, Billy was anything but a healthy child. And his mother and her relatives often despaired of his life. He was small at birth, lacking in strength, and for some reason did not gain rapidly as his brothers had done. Then we read, an old French doctor living in the neighborhood prescribed some herb remedies that seemed to be just the thing, for they soon had the boy going toward robust health. So, he's a young boy, 3 years old, sickly, but he was small most of his life. Now, his mother remarried a man named Heiser. A couple more children were born, and he lived a fairly normal life, though still poor, still the family somewhat dependent on help from Squire Corey, the grandfather, and that worked until 1874. There was a great economic downturn in this country in 1874, and Heiser, the husband, stepfather, left the family and has never heard from again. Now, at this point, the family moved back in with grandparents, Squire Corey and his wife, but Billy Sunday was pretty headstrong at this point, and he and his grandfather butted heads quite often, and it was determined that they couldn't afford all these children, and so Billy Sunday and his brother were sent to an orphanage. Now, that left a huge imprint on Billy Sunday, those years in the orphanage, because there was a very strict management. You know, any behavior that was negative would get a demerit, and with demerits you lost privileges, and so this was a time somebody who was known as a pretty free spirit, and somebody who, you know, butted heads with his grandfather, certainly with his stepfather as well, and now he's in this structured area and he hated it. He was there for 2 years until 1876, when he was 16 years old. He was off on his own. And he tried to go back home, but his grandfather basically after a very short time said, you know, you and I don't get together. We just can't make it work. And so he was off. He went to the local town. He got a job at a hotel. He lost that. He could run really fast. And so he got a job at a fire station, since they needed messengers who could run fast to bring a message from one place to another, or if there was a call for the fire engines to come out to make a run around to call the volunteer fire department. And so Billy Sunday became a runner for the fire department. In 1833 is when he began a baseball career. He played on the local Marshalltown baseball team in Iowa. And in 1833, his baseball team won the championship of that area of Iowa. And a man who saw him play happened to be the coach of the Chicago White Stockings. And so he signed him to a contract, and Billy Sunday became a professional baseball player. And man who signed them to that contract was that man there. And he was a baseball player. He had become a coach, and he's well known. He's famous, and that's his old baseball card. You'll notice those were very, very popular back then. And so he's a baseball player. He has two records for which he was known. One is that he was able to run from a standing position at home plate around all the bases in 14 seconds. And that's a record that, to my knowledge, still stands. And a second record, which held for many, many years until 1915, was that he stole 95 bases. In 1915, Ty Cobb is the one who broke that record. So, Billy Sunday, and he is known for his baseball playing and the culture that surrounded it back then, of hard-drinking, hard-living people. At this point, he recognizes no faith in his life, no faith in God in his life, but he was focused on baseball. One time he described his baseball career this way. He said an event that set him apart. He said, as I saw the ball rise in the air, I knew it was going clear over my head into the crowd that overflowed the field. I turned my back and ran. The field was crowded with people, and as I ran, I yelled, "Get out of the way!" And that crowd opened like the Red Sea for the rod of Moses. I ran on, and as I ran, I made a prayer. It wasn't theological either, I tell you. I said, "God, if you ever helped a mortal man, help me to get that ball." I ran and jumped over the bench when I thought I was under it and stopped. I looked back and saw it going over my head, and I jumped and shoved out my left hand, and the ball hit it and stuck. At that rate, at the rate I was going, the momentum carried me on and I fell under the feet of a team of horses. But I held onto it and jumped up with a ball in my hand. And that's the Billy Sunday that history records. Powerful man, powerful capability to run fast. Of course, back then they didn't have the stadiums like we have now, but people would gather on the outside of the outfield, and so that's how he could run into the crowd and run into a horse there. Now, 1886, he experienced conversion. That happened in Chicago. He and the ball players that were his friends were getting tanked, is the way he put it. They were coming out of a tavern, and there was a group from the Pacific Garden Mission who were inviting the ball players to come in. Now, most of them just laughed it off, but for some reason, Billy Sunday went in. He went in, and he heard the message, and began to respond. Now, the word on your, the name on your screen, Mrs. Clark, is there because she was instrumental. Now, here again, like Edward Kimball with Dwight Moody, Mrs. Clark is somebody that history does not record. In other words, she had no significant place in history other than being the person who discipled Dwight, or who discipled Billy Sunday to the point of conversion. And so he's converted, and he began to get involved with the YMCA. Those years, 1890 to 91, he was closely associated with the YMCA. And began doing speaking in a variety of places with the YMCA. And there came a point of real challenge for him, and that is, would he do revival full-time? Now, that was a challenge because he was, at that point, under contract to a baseball team. And so he began to pray. He set out kind of a fleece that, you know, God, if you release me from my baseball contract, he said, I will go into full-time revival kind of ministry. And the release came. Now, that was a real challenge because when people heard he was released, another baseball team offered him a humongous amount, $500 per month. Now, in 1890, that was a lot of money. Instead, he stayed true to what he felt God was calling him to do. He stayed with the revivalist YMCA, working with them, and got $83.33 a month doing that. Now, at 1893, there was a downturn economically in the country. Donations to the YMCA went on a downturn as well. And so he went to work then for J. Wilbur Chapman, who is a well-known revivalist. And so he became one of the gophers, one of the people who helped set up the revivals that would go into town. And then for some reason that Chapman never wrote of, he decided in 1895 to quit. He just quit being a revivalist. And there were some days and weeks scheduled ahead for revivals, and Chapman said to Billy Sunday, "Oh, you can do it." And at that point, Billy Sunday hadn't written a message at all, and so Chapman sent him a couple of messages that he could use as sermons, and Billy Sunday tried to learn them, and 1895 is when we hear of his first revival. Now, began meeting in towns and became incredibly popular because he was a showman first class. And in fact, at one point there was a plywood tabernacle, and there's a picture of it, a plywood tabernacle built for his ministry that would seat 16,000 people. Now, imagine the safety codes that thing just wouldn't happen today. But 16,000 people crammed into this plywood tabernacle. And the height of his popularity was New York in 1917. The reality is that he became extremely popular during the First World War. In fact, he showed up in one town the day after war had been declared on Germany, and of course people were ready to hear a message, and you know, during those years of the First World War, he had a powerfully patriotic message and an anti-drink message. He became very much a proponent of prohibition. And it happened. 1919, prohibition happened. And from that point on, Billy Sunday became less and less popular. Some of his lack of his popularity had to do with his claim that he could deliver converts for $2 a soul. And so many people in the church just felt that was rather crass. He applied to be ordained. He was not ordained. In the Presbyterian Church. And here's a description of his examination. In his examination before the presbytery, the former ball player was plied with questions for an hour or more by the professors of theology and the learned members of the body. He answered their questions to their entire satisfaction, and his orthodoxy was pronounced sound in every particular. Occasionally, some erudite professor would ask him a question that was a poser, one to think about, in other words, to which he would immediately reply, "That's too deep for me, or I'll have to pass that up." And yet, the motion was made as he was under this examination by somebody who simply said, "Let's just pass him." And so they did. So that's one. God's response was to the downturn was continue of revivals, the continue of challenging people to faith. The other response was the beginning of the Pentecostal movement. Now, a lot of this is traced to this man, Charles F. Palmer. Palmer, June 4, 1873, October 1900, he established a school in Topeka, Kansas. So he's a young man, but he had this idea that we should be able to speak in tongues as a response to reading the book of Acts, that the natural response, he believed, should be speaking in tongues. And so he began to teach that and to preach it. But it wasn't until January 1, 1901, where a Miss Osmond, picture on the screen there, they were in an all-night prayer meeting to introduce the new year. So it was a watch night prayer meeting, such as many churches there. And sometime after midnight, this young woman asked for Parham to lay hands on her and to ask for her to receive the gift of speaking in tongues. Parham himself had not yet spoken in tongues. And so this is how Parham records that event. "I had scarcely repeated 36 sentences when a glory fell upon her. A halo seemed to surround her head and face, and she began speaking in the Chinese language and was unable to speak English for 3 days. Now, after that, things began to take off. April 9, 1906 is known as one of the great dates in the history of Pentecostalism, because that's when the Azusa Street Revival began. The man in the picture, William J. Seymour, was one of Parham's students. Somebody came out of the experience of Parham schools and had been baptized with the Spirit, as he began to refer to it, and had gone to Los Angeles and said, "You should send somebody out here to further this." William Seymour was the man that was sent. And so he came out to Los Angeles, was invited to preach in a church, and when he presented his idea that we should be speaking in tongues, was forced out. He went into a home, was invited into a home to preach, and eventually that happened, that they rented facilities on Azusa Street, and that is a picture of it, and revival began to happen in that way, and that Pentecostalism, which was going to begin to impact the entire church. Now, at this point, it was a marginalized group, and eventually in Texas, they said there were about 25,000 Pentecostalists by 1910, or the end of the World War I. It was a growing movement, but it was very slow because they were considered to be mostly poor. It was considered to be highly emotional. It wasn't considered to be really mainline at all. But what began there with an emphasis on the Holy Spirit was something that was going to carry through the church and impact it much later, as we're going to see in subsequent lectures.